It just completely throws me off. We have a great couple of panelists for you to listen to today. I'm glad to have you all here. I do want to talk a little bit, well, first of all, to my class, a reminder that you have papers due, and the syllabus that's on Canvas describes what those papers are to be. And those papers are due the last day of class. So that's that Monday in December. And I don't have the date right in my mind at this point. But please keep that in mind. We've had a lot of good things that we've talked about. And I think there's a lot there for you to look at and analyze. Then last week, we talked a little bit about, somebody asked a question about ponds. We listened to Greg Peterson, who was talking from an ag perspective on water sustainability. It was a bit confusing, and I got an email from Barbara Galloway, who listens to the class online, and she mentioned that the Colorado Division of Water Resources has a pond management booklet to look at that starts from the beginning. And here's what you need to know to set up a pond on your land. So I just thank you very much, Barbara, for looking that up. And I wanted to let everybody know that there is some easy answers that you can look up on the Division of Water Resources website. So today we're going to talk about equity, diversity, and inclusion with water. And it's my great pleasure to introduce these two women who do live in the Valley, San Luis Valley. Rio de la Vista is the director of the Salazar Rio Grande del Norte Center at Adams State University, where she shares her experience with local, regional, international, nonprofit organizations, land and water issues. I got to know Rio when she worked for the Rio Grande Headwaters Land Trust, which she was there for 20 years. And we had a lot of great conversations. And the Land Trust has completed about a conservation of 25,000 acres of land and water along the Rio Grande and the Canales. What I didn't know is that Rio is a graduate of journalism from CU. What I do know is she's co-authored a book, an eco-novel called The Ogland, A Hero's Journey Across Africa. So for those of you interested in eco-novels, I think you might want to look at that.
For young readers.
Rhonda Lobata is a board member of the Castilla County Conservancy District. She's a sixth-generation Colorado native. She lives in San Luis, which is the oldest town of Colorado, with her family. She is a certified residential appraiser and chief appraiser, deputy assessor for the Castilla County Assessor's Office. She serves not only on the Castilla County Board, District Board, but she does serve on the Rio Grande Basin Roundtable. So welcome to both of these women. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to the class. And with that, Rio, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, thank you, Jennifer, and I appreciate Rhonda joining me for this presentation today. I'm going to go through some topics and then hand it over to her. So I'm going to share my screen, and you can see a little bit of our valley from the air and how much, I guess, when I look at this, I know why I love this place so much, because it's amazing beauty. And this is the where the Conejos River is confluence with the Rio Grande, looking north towards Mount Blanca in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. So we're this high mountain valley, and like a lot of mountain areas, that snow up in the mountains is our water for the spring and summer. And this was taken during a nice wet year, so that's why it's so beautiful. But I Well, before I move on to that, yes, I'm the director at the Salazar Rio Grande del Norte Center at Adams State. And after working with the land trust for those many years, I realized I wasn't going to get it all done. And I wanted to help grow the next generation of water leaders, conservation activists, those kind of fields. So this opportunity at Adams State came to me. And I have been on the Rio Grande Basin Roundtable, the environmental rep on the roundtable for a number of years, or actually since it started in 2005. And when I was invited to be on this water equity task force by the Colorado Water Conservation Board, I was like, me? You know what? This is not an area that I have expertise as any kind of an academic or a researcher or anything, but I do care a great deal about it. So that's why I titled this today was Questions, because I think certainly that's where I'm at with it, is I have more questions than answers. And I just thought we could begin to explore that some together. And I will appreciate your thoughts. We were going to ask you to hold the questions, certainly put them in the chat and hold them till the end. And then we can get through our kind of presentation part. I ask you a lot of questions, so maybe they'll help spark some discussion when we get to the to that after this. So this is... we had the Water Equity Task Force with the put together by Colorado Water Conservation Board held a workshop, and like a lot of things, was ended up being a virtual workshop. And one of the topics that emerged from that is the one that I'm going to kind of work through a little bit here at the beginning, because it just seems like such a, if anything, it's, I call it the bottom line of water equity, and that is access to clean, adequate, accessible water supply. And I'm going to ask, maybe you can raise your hands or something, but at least ask yourself, how many of you personally know someone personally who grew up in the U.S. in Colorado, maybe without running water, without electricity? And the founder of the center where I and the director, Ken Salazar, and his family grew up without running water and electricity in their home. And obviously it didn't hold him back, because now he and his family have gone on to pretty amazing careers, but that's not the case for everyone. And I'm just also curious if any of you personally know anyone who currently lives without running water and without electricity. And I do, I have had the opportunity to spend some time on the Navajo Reservation, and there's a number of people in that part of our world that don't yet have clean water or running water or electricity in their homes. So there's this wonderful organization called digdeep.org, which I had heard about, and then it was cited a number of times during that water equity workshop as well. And they're working on doing water, bringing water to many areas that are lacking it. And this was their definition of equitable water access. Basically that it's safe, it's water quality that doesn't hurt your health when you drink it. It's acceptable in terms of its color, odor. I lived in a house with a fairly smelly well, so I appreciate that. That it's accessible, that it's something that it's, you know, both water input to the house and wastewater services are accessible. It's affordable, where you don't, it's not going to be out of reach economically to whomever they're talking about here. And that it's non-discriminatory, that the access to those services are not dependent on these various criteria that are listed here, like race, ethnicity, national origin, citizenship, gender, age, income, housing situation, geography, religion, creed, those various things which all seem to find ways of discriminating against people based on those. So with that definition, then they also look at what are the historical causes of water access challenges. And the one communities, this really makes sense on many dimensions of our world right now, but the communities that were historically unable to develop water infrastructure, currently the decline in funding makes it even harder for them to catch up and to install that infrastructure that they're needed. And this comparison kind of on the right points that out. In 1977, 63% of the capital spending for water and wastewater systems were from federal agencies, and now that's less than 9%. So where's that other 54% of funding going to come from? I don't have the answer. I have the question. So across the nation, they have found that federal data doesn't accurately measure this water access gap. And of all the predictors of a lack of access to water, race is the strongest predictor. Poverty, of course, is the obstacle. Water access affects not only the individuals that are struggling with it, but the entire community. And that even while some progress is occurring, some communities are actually going backwards. So this statistic is pretty sobering, that more than 2 million Americans currently live without basic access to safe drinking water and sanitation. They say 250,000 in Puerto Rico, over 500,000 homeless people, and then another 1.4 million people lack that access. So who's affected? As we said, race is one of the biggest factors. Black and Latinx households are twice as likely as white households to lack indoor plumbing. The next slide, Native American households are 19 times more likely than white households to lack indoor plumbing. So we have a lot of issues that needed to be addressed. And on the right here, it's an estimated 30% of the Navajo people in the Navajo Nation lack access to running water and have to haul their water. And that number may not even be accurate. It could be higher than that. So I don't know, Jennifer, I remember last year you had an amazing presentation about tribal water rights. Have you had that this semester, something along those lines?
No, we haven't, but I've been on the reservation. I've seen a 90-year-old woman drive 60 miles both ways to get her water.
Right. And so, you know, one of the points here is that many of these tribes have substantial water rights, but they maybe didn't have the funding originally to be able to access them and put in the expensive infrastructure for household or agricultural or other uses. So even while they have the right to that water, they don't have access to it. So that's another hurdle that is ahead of us. And what are the consequences of that? This was during the water conservation, the Water Equity Task Force workshop. And I mean, the lack of access to water has life and death consequences, especially during the COVID pandemic here. When you look at this statistic, Heather Tanana was the keynote speaker at that workshop, and it's all there, this link, you can watch the whole entire workshop and her talk. You look at this, you know, among white population, 1 in 16,000 people died of COVID. Asians, the same. Blacks, 1 in 4,900. Hispanics, 1 in 4,700. Native Americans, 1 in 1,800 people. So there's a direct correlation between the access to that water. What were we told during the pandemic? Wash your hands. So if you don't have clean water, you can't even do that basic service for yourself and to keep yourself and your family safe. So as I said, it says life and death consequences. And again, this article, I did a lot of research looking around to get things, information for this talk. And it's not hard to find, but this is the Water Education Organization in California that did this article about the shortages loom. I know you've been hearing about that in this class, in the Colorado River, the Indian tribes are seeking to secure those water rights. And then also to figure out how to access them. So the questions that have come up to me as I've been thinking about this and preparing for today, it's like who benefits from this inequity? I think who would benefit from increased equity? You know, who benefits from the lack of diversity? Who would benefit from greater diversity? And with inclusion, you know, who benefits from that lack of inclusion and who would benefit from greater inclusion? That kind of relates to that time-honored thing about follow the money, I believe. And those are worth asking, I believe. And then I thought too about the past. I mean, we have historical inequities right here in our community of Spanish-speaking people that maybe had land and water. And then when this area used to be part of old Mexico and now became part of the United States, new laws came in and maybe people weren't able to, didn't understand the language or the governmental system and maybe lost their water rights as the government changed. So there's one example of historical inequity. Some of those continue today. There's present inequities. How do we deal with those? And how do we, while we're at it, prevent future ones? And I really, having, as Jennifer said, my degree is in journalism, so I'm always thinking about how we communicate things. How do we inspire change? So how do we reach across these political, social, cultural divides to find solutions to these many, many issues, just a couple of which I touched on? I said, what kind of language will be heard? You know, I think about, I listened into Greg Peterson last week, and I mean, that's a very specific audience. The agricultural audience is one. Tribal leaders would be another. You know, Black people living in the urban community would be another. How do we, you know, I don't think there's one message, but we need messages and we need information. And we need to be, I want to be sensitive about the messages I put out so that I'm as respectful as I can be of people as I'm trying to address issues that I may not even know much about. And then finally, what will motivate the changes we need? So in thinking about this too, I remembered a poem. Maybe some of you have heard of this. Oh, this is, I'm not quite there yet. So I wanted to say, I think there's a huge relationship between water equity and these other issues of our time. Environmental justice, climate justice, social justice, loss of biodiversity. This is just from this week. I mean, obviously we have huge conversation going on about climate change right now. And I think climate change and water are absolutely inextricably linked. So, and I think it's clear that climate change is affecting people of color, poverty, and other situations way more than some other people. So this is the poem that I kept thinking of as I was getting ready. So I looked it up and found it online, and maybe you guys are familiar with it, but it's the title is First They Came. First They Came for the Communists. This was written around the time of World War II. First they came for the communists, and I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me. There was no one left to speak out for me. So another headline I saw this week is, at least 85% of the world's population has been affected by human-induced climate change. So I'm going, who's the 15% that's not affected? I mean, it seems like it's affecting all of us. So we're all, this really is all of us in this. And in my work in conservation over the years, it's not just humans. It's all the systems, ecological, all the other life that we share this planet with that are being equally affected by it. So I adapted this poem just the other day in getting ready for this, and I called it First They Came Also. So I'll read this for you. First they came for the wildlife, and I did not speak out because I'm not wild, though I like to see the birds and deer and coyote. Then they came for the forest, and I did not speak out because I do not live in the forest, though I built my home of wood. Then they came for the farmland, and I did not speak out because I'm not a farmer, though I need the food they grow to feed my family. Then they came for the rivers, and I did not speak out because I do not live by a river, though the river brings the water that feeds the farms, the bird, the deer, the coyote. Then they changed our climate, and I did not speak out because I need the gasoline to drive my car, the coal to power my home, though the floods and fires and heat endanger my very life. Then they came for the water, and I could not speak because I was too thirsty. So I hope it touches you that we're all in it together in this beautiful image and words from a Native American who's inspired me for many years, John Trudell. This poster's in my office at Adams State. So we must listen. The water sings. The water sings life. Mother Earth is our natural delight. The water roars and rises in spirit strength. The water tells us we are one. So I'm really happy to pass this on to Rhonda Lobato, whose life and sixth generation lives this every day. So I'm going to give it to Rhonda, and I'll advance the slides for you.
Hello, I'm Rhonda Lobato. I'm a sixth generation Parsiante. So I'll talk about Parsiante in a moment. This is a picture of the Montes and San Luis People's Ditch right in town, right in San Luis. And San Luis is the oldest town of Colorado. Go ahead, next slide. So acequia, here is the pronunciation of acequia. The definition of acequia is simply an irrigation ditch, but the meaning of acequia is so much more. Acequias are a way of life for our small community of farmers and ranchers in southern Colorado. They've existed in the southern half of Costilla, Conejos, and Las Animas counties since before they were called counties. Next slide. Before Colorado became a state, acequias were hand dug by the first settlers of what is now Colorado. Next slide. Costilla County was or is a Mexican land grant, and it was the first area of the state of Colorado to be colonized, with a recorded history dating back to 1540, the year Coronado explored the Southwest. Sangre de Cristo land grant was awarded to Narciso Bubian in January of 1844. 4 years later, his father, Carlos Bubian, took possession of the land, which spanned more than 1 million acres in the San Luis Valley in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. The grant was approved by Congress in 1860 and sold to former Colorado territorial governor William Gilpin in 1864. Next slide. So my ancestors were among the original settlers, and as an incentive to settle lands, Bobian deeded perpetual communal rights to La Sierra, which is the mountain, and La Vega, the meadow, to the settlers. In the photo, you can see Culebra Peak with our snowmelt. It's in the shape of a bird, if you can see that. Lands along the rivers of the Culebra watershed were deeded to the settlers in vada strips. These are strips of land so that each landowner would have access to water to irrigate their crops. These settlers hand dug earthen ditches called acequias. Next slide. So here's a picture that you can see the strips of land and how the different ownerships are. And this is a current picture. We still have vada strips in Costilla County. Next slide. So why is this important? The acequia community consists of villages within these vada strips. There are several villages in the southern half of Costilla County: San Francisco, Los Fuertes, San Pablo, San Francisco, Chama, Chama Canyon, San Luis, La Corriera, and San Acacio. These are the villages where acequias exist to irrigate crops and raise livestock. These villages thrive off of the Culebra watershed. Next slide. So the outline here is the Culebra watershed. You can see Culebra Peak and the mountain range, where our snowpack is collecting snow for our water. Next slide. This is a map of the acequias in the watershed, the tributaries. There's actually a lot more acequias that come off of these main tributaries. Go ahead. So how the acequia community works Each acequia has a mayordomo, which is the manager, and every parciante, which is the property owner on the ditch, has a vote. Each acequia has an annual meeting where they appoint a mayordomo. This usually happens at an annual meeting or gathering in the spring when the parciantes on an acequia gather to clean their ditch before irrigation season starts. The mayordomo uses a rotational schedule to ensure that each parciante has their turn to water their crops. This practice has always been used for acequias in the Culebra watershed, and we hold keeping water tied to the land very sacred. So our history and our legacy. Right now, the eighth generation of original settlers are now learning the acequia traditions of our ancestors. It's vital to us that we educate our children how to carry on this practice. We've established several organizations in our community to ensure that our land and water is preserved and protected. They include the Sangre de Cristo Acequia Association, the Costilla County Conservancy District, and the Land Rights Council. The Costilla County Conservancy District is now conducting a watershed assessment of the Culebra watershed in order to protect our land and water for the future. And this was made possible by the Colorado Water Conservancy Board and other funders. This is a picture of our, that was a picture of our senior class last year cleaning ditches. My daughter's the one on the far right.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. And then the next slide. I'm going to show you all a video of just what acequia community means to us. And this is my youngest daughter, Josefina. She's narrating the video.
So I'm going to stop sharing. And you're going to run the video, right?
Can you guys see that okay?
Yes.
Can you make it full screen?
Yep.
Yeah, if you can make it full screen. There you go. Go.
It's
I don't hear
it
now.
Is there audio?
Yeah, we heard it before. I heard it for a second.
I heard it start.
You want to go back to the beginning?
I muted myself. Let me try again.
Yeah, take it back to the beginning.
It's something I've been told my whole life.
There you go.
If we take care of the land and water, it takes care of us. And the us isn't just family. My whole community is part of it. We listen to the land and we listen to each other. And all of us try to make the water work for everyone. That's me, Josefina. But everybody calls me Fina. I live in San Luis, Colorado. Our family has lived here for a long time. My great-great-great-great-grandparents came to settle on this land before Colorado was even a state. That was a really long time ago. They picked these lands because they're beautiful and because they have everything our community needs. Good soil to raise crops and hay, water for growing foods, and wood for building houses and fires. Over 100 years ago, they hand-dug ditches, which we call acequias. Each family got a piece of land that had enough water for what they needed. It's just sharing. Acequias means so much more than a ditch to my family. To us, acequia means community, and it means sharing. Some of the families don't live here anymore, and new families have moved here. But no matter when you came or how much land you have or don't have, everyone along the acequia gets an equal vote in how we use water. We make sure that in dry years, everyone still gets a little water to keep their farm going. I think if my grandfathers were still here, they would be glad to see that we are still using what they taught us. Sometimes the old ways are still the good ways. Someday, when I'm older like my mom and dad, I'll teach my own kids our traditions. We take care of the land and water, and we take care of each other. That's what it means to be part of an acequia. If we take care of the land and water, it takes care of us.
Right. Well, we'll put the link for that in the chat because it seemed a little jumpy. It's much smoother than that when I've seen it before. But
yeah. I think we'll open it up to questions then.
So, Brenda, the first question, since I'm moderator, I get a first shot at this, is how does the acequias work with Colorado water law? What's that connection?
Yeah, so it's really different. We have to abide by Colorado water law, of course, and Division of Water Resources is a governing body for the acequias as well. However, they allow our community to pretty much dictate the water sharing. Each ditch is on the priority system, and so it's actually kind of a little awkward to think about, but our very first water right and the first water right of the state is actually one of the furthest from the mountain. And so when we're doing our water sharing, those ditches that are furthest from the mountain have the highest priority. So they water first and then it goes backwards up the mountain. So it is very different, a different process of irrigation.
But it's meshed into the water law system, essentially.
Yes, and actually, acequia water law was not recognized until 2009. Yeah.
I remember that. That was going to be my next question. So yeah. That I thought was a great improvement. Rio, Brennan had a question, and Brennan, I'm going to let you go ahead and unmute yourself and ask your question.
Yeah, so what I was curious about earlier, if I recall correctly, in defining water equity, you had several components of it, like affordability, accessibility, and then a couple others. And I was wondering if you would also include reliability in those components that define water equity. Would you say reliability is an important factor in defining water equity?
Well, thanks, Brendan. And yeah, and those, as I said, came from that organization, digdeep.org. And definitely, I mean, reliability, it's not accessible, but it's not reliable. So I think that's really critical. And that's, you know, something we're all up against with the water scarcity that it seems to be on the horizon for many of our areas, certainly for the future of agriculture in our community in the San Luis Valley. We're facing some serious water reliability issues, partly from overuse and overpumping of our aquifers and many other groundwater dependent places. they have that issue, and then obviously the issue of just even the annual water supply, depending on rain and snowfall.
Rio, talk a little bit about the wells in the valley and what's going on there. Can you just give a brief summary?
Sure. There, you know, that like a lot of places, I mean, the San Luis Valley, that valley floor, even though that first picture in the slideshow showed it looking really wet, I was going, wait, why do I show these pictures of all this water? Because it's really dry here typically, but the valley floor gets 6 to 8 inches of rain. So over many years since the early settlers started establishing agriculture, and then as agriculture grew and grew, that, you know, that water, that snowmelt water supply, the surface water, a lot of times would be gone by, or certainly by July. And at the same time where they dug wells, there's such a water underneath the valley that they had artesian wells. There's pictures of water shooting 20 feet in the air from the high pressure artesian wells that were here. But so wells were dug, and then as rural electrification happened and pump technology increased, then more wells were drilled. And now they've been, there was a moratorium on those in the 1970s, but the thousands and thousands of wells that sustain their agricultural economic base here have depleted the aquifer underneath us, along combined with the lack of recharge and a lot of dry years. So we have to get those things back in balance, and it's not going to be an easy road ahead for the people that have well-based dependent agriculture. I think Greg talked about that quite a bit last week too.
Yeah, it just is a important piece of the valley, I think, taking on the challenge. And as Greg said, you know, taxing themselves essentially to work towards the problem. So it's another community story in my mind.
Yeah. And there's, you know, we also have the risk of exportation where, you know, as the Thirsty Front Range wants to grow, where they're looking for water, and, you know, we don't feel it. I mean, our system, the Rio Grande, was totally appropriated before 1900. So then you have these wells that came in decades after that, you know, started impacting, because it took a while for groundwater and surface water law to even, be recognized as being interactive. And so now those wells are, many of them are 100 years junior. I mean, like Rhonda said, the first water right in Colorado is the People's Ditch in San Luis, in, I think, 1852. And a lot of these wells weren't drilled or dug for many decades after that. So now we have those impacting the surface rights, and then the threat of exportation. So a lot of times we're a microcosm of all these water issues of the West, except thank goodness we don't have fracking.
So, Brian Steen, why don't you go ahead and ask your question?
Hi, I was just curious as to whether or not with prior appropriation, since that is the dominant water law over aquaceas, and the fact that with prior appropriation, water rights are not tied to land, I was wondering if it's been a challenge to keep water from aquaceas actually tied to land within the valley. And then is that somehow insured within the community?
So it has been a challenge. Our conservancy district actually, the community doesn't believe that water should be taken from the land. And so most of the ditches in our Acequia community have incorporated and created bylaws so that the water has to stay with the land. If a property owner wants to sell the water separately, they have to, they're starting to write in the bylaws that the ditch itself would have a first right of refusal in order to get that water right. But it really isn't, There's I only know of two cases where the water has been separated from the land. And the first one that happened, it was a case where a couple got divorced and the water judge separated, gave the wife the water and the husband the land. And so the Conservancy District actually had to step in at that time. And, you know, the lady didn't want the water. She wanted out and she wanted money. And so the Conservancy District stepped in and bought that water from her and leased it back to the owner. And actually this year, we just sold that water right back to the owner of the land. So it's a big deal in our community. People are very protective of the water staying tied to the land here.
Is there a reason the judge did that?
It's called splitting the baby.
I have no idea what he was thinking. We were very concerned that it would set a precedence, and that's why the Conservancy District stepped in at that time and did what we could to ensure that that water wasn't leaving.
Was the judge the water judge down there, or was it a separate judge?
I think he was a water judge.
Okay.
Yeah. Worst judge.
I don't want to throw him under the bus.
No. I was just curious. Dixie, you had a question.
Oh, can I, before I
put, oh, go ahead, in the,
I put in the chat an article about the bill that was passed when Ed Vigil was our state representative, that, and I can't speak to this with a lot of knowledge, but integrated Esekis into Colorado water law in a way that allows them to continue their traditional water distribution versus the priority system overlay. So anyway, that link is there.
Good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Dixie, you had a question.
Yeah. I was just curious on how the annual meetings for the Esekis, I always thought that Mayor Domo was like the, was even a cooler term than ditch rider. So, but I was just curious how those differ, or if they do, from our basin roundtables that we've been learning about.
I believe the annual meetings are a lot more informal. Everybody on the ditch gathers to clean the ditch. They burn, all of the overgrowth of weeds and, whatever trash has gathered throughout the winter time. And they usually do a potluck. And so it's really communal. You know, we can't have a meeting in my community without bringing food. People won't come. So it's very informal. Although they feed us at the round table as well.
The round tables were formed. I mean, the Esekis started in the 1850s and existed long before that in New Mexico. And I think even have roots all the way back to Northern Africa and Spain. So, but the round tables were started in 2005, set up by the Colorado State Legislature to get people to talk to each other within the basin and have all these different representatives. Rhonda is on there. I'm on there. A lot of different people. So it's, a totally different structure, but
right.
Certainly in our community, we're trying to, make sure that, and also we're the step down from the Colorado Water Conservation Board for grant funding and stuff. So we've, I think over the years, been really trying to make sure that the water is spread around our community to all the different water users and types of needs. So we've helped fund a bunch, we as a roundtable work to bring water to some of the Esekis in the San Luis area as well. So
I was just going to note that I worked with Pueblos in New Mexico, and what Rhonda described as their annual ditch cleaning is very ceremonial to the Pueblos. And it probably is, Rhonda, to your folks too. I don't know if they let the women pick a shovel and help, but in the Pueblo community, They, you know, the men and the boys, men take off a day of work and the boys come in and they share stories and they clean the ditch. And the women then bring the food. Mm-hmm. It's always there. So that that just reminded me of my work with the Pueblos. Jan, you have a question.
Yes, thank you for this great presentation. I wanted to ask, you know, I believe in getting back to our roots is the best thing for the future. But I wanted to ask if there's anything that you have learned throughout this community or anything that we can take towards the future in other areas. For instance, the eastern slope of the Colorado. We have a lot of, you know, problems with irrigation water and demand and all of that. But I was wondering if you knew of a way to kind of get back to our roots and use kind of the techniques that your community has, but use the technology that we now have.
Speaking of technology, right now we are doing a thorough watershed assessment for the Culebra watershed. Our conservancy district, it's been so long. I started this back in 2017, and it's taken a lot of time and money and collaboration and resources to put something like this together for our community. With this watershed assessment, we are trying to pinpoint efficiency, water structures, what is working, what is not working, what can we do as a community to replace our infrastructure for efficiency. So we're trying to learn as we're doing this assessment as well. I don't know the specifics of the techniques of irrigation on the eastern side of Colorado, but I do know it's very dry. And I know some farmers out in the eastern plains that, you know, are desperate for water. So any kind of conservation practice that, you know, we could share, it's, and across the state, it's not just, you know, Acequias, it's collaborating and coming together as a water community to teach each other. Yeah.
Thank you.
Rio, do you have any thoughts?
Sure. Thank you, Jen. That's a, if we had the best answer for that, it would be solve a lot of problems. So that's really goes back to the roots of the round tables, I think, was to try to, first of all, within the every basin, to get people to talk to each other more and understand each other's history and, you know, the San Luis Valley, we're a vast geographic area, but we're only about 46,000 people. So I think that serves us in the sense that we can get to know a lot of people and work together. And we have, I think, over the years, but then every basin and then also the roundtable setup also created the Interbasin Compact Committee that's getting the basins to talk to each other and realizing that the days of buying water out of these rural communities and transporting it to grow urban communities at the expense of the environment and the agricultural production in those source water areas, just they need to be in the past. You know, we can't afford to keep drying up these areas, which are already pretty dry to start with, to just continue to grow. And those are big challenges because we have property rights and economic development and all these things that are driving those changes. But, you know, hopefully if one of my favorite sayings too is people protect what they love, you know, and if people come to our community and other rural communities and see, you know, to recreate, to access cultural experiences and like visiting San Luis is a beautiful thing to do and see the way of life there and the historical buildings and things that are there. So they see that and they go, well, we don't really want to change that. How do we get a balance here so that we can grow where we need to grow, but also not do that at the expense of these other communities that have been here for a long time and also want to have a viable future, along with all the things like in my poem about all the wildlife and everything that we share this planet with.
Yeah. Just to add on to what Rio was talking about, when we started our journey with this watershed assessment in Southern Costilla County, we reached out to the other conservancy districts throughout the valley, and they've been very helpful in helping us to not have to reinvent the wheel in our stakeholder meetings. And so we've actually, it's been a few years where we've collaborated with several of our projects and have just worked together to really teach each other about our communities. So it's sharing and working together. That's key.
Great, thanks. Joe, you have your hand up.
Yeah, I have two questions. If I can ask them both, that'd be awesome.
Go ahead.
The first is, I was just wanting to know a little bit more about the history of the Acequia system and like how static it's been over time or how much it's changed. So I'm thinking about things like, has the amount of irrigated land changed much over time, or like have the ditches been expanded? Have there been more ditches dug over time? And like, have you added any like new technology, like metering technology or anything like that?
So the acequias were, they're pretty historical. It was part of what was given to our ancestors, you know, because it was a land grant. They took the technology of acequias from New Mexico. That's where our ancestors were from. They came up from Santa Fe and Taos to settle these lands. And there are acequias in the system that are not incorporated or have even been registered. And so there's a conscious effort right now through the Sangre de Cristo Acequia Association with CU attorneys, actually, that are, they work for the Acequia Association to try to incorporate those ditches. So new ditches aren't allowed, but the ones that are existing have existed for a really long time. They just haven't been registered or on the records, I guess, through the state of Colorado.
And I think, I mean, that whole project with CU Law School has just been, I think, really helped the community, because as things change and the demand for water increases, then those unincorporated acequias were way more vulnerable to water. Yeah. Someone coming in and being able to transfer water out of them. And now as they create bylaws and become more formalized, it gives them a whole nother layer of protection to keep that water tied to the land there, as I understand it, right? Does that sound right, Rhonda?
Yeah.
And isn't it, but you also say that through time though, as generations of people on that same land base, that, you know, say you have three daughters, right? I mean, does your land get split three ways? I mean, that happens across all different cultures where the land sometimes gets split. But is that partly why some of the varos are very narrow, is because they might have been wider a few generations ago and then they got split?
Yeah. So the whole concept was that each vada strip of land was along a river or a ditch, and that's how the lands were settled. As time went by, families grew and they split the land. And so the ditches, you know, were extended to the farmland. You can't really you can't really create a brand new ditch. The waterways on your land, you can dig every year if you need to.
Put the ownership up some of those bars, make them there. So that's partly how they, as I understand it, how they got to be some of those fairly narrow strips, but still everybody had that access across the whole landscape.
Joe, you said you had another question?
Yeah. I think in the video, it mentioned that in times of like water shortage or drought, that the goal is to try and give everyone in the system enough water so they can still keep their, you know, farm or ranching operation going. And I was wondering how that works with prior appropriation, because from my understanding, it's like, if there's not enough water, then whoever's most senior gets the water. They get to use their whole right, and then whoever is junior doesn't get any water. I was just curious about like, how formal is that sort of system of, because it seems like the way it works in the valley is like it's the shortage is almost shared amongst everybody so that people can still be functional even in drought.
That's the ideal case. So like I said earlier, the first water right is the San Luis People's Ditch. And that's it's pretty far away from the headwaters. But the junior water right holders are closest to the headwaters. And so it just depends on how much water there is. And we really, really depend a lot on rainwater. You know, this year was a fantastic year for crops, but that I have seen years where everything is just extremely dry. Nobody has water. And it's actually pretty devastating because, you know, families grow their own food here. And, you know, going back to that grassroots question, we're not really big farmers, but the farmland that we do use is to sustain ourselves. And so it does get really tricky when there is absolutely no water. And so we're more apt to share our water.
I mentioned, Joe, I should have shown a map of the whole San Luis Valley because it's six counties, the entire Rio Grande Basin. And the area where the sequias operate is in the southeast part of the valley on the Calabria watershed, mm-hmm. which due to, I don't know when it stopped reaching the Rio Grande, but the Calabria River no longer flows into the Rio Grande. So the rest of the valley is under prior appropriation. All the wells I'm talking about, actual agriculture, is a whole different, it's under the conventional statewide prior appropriation system, all the waters of the Rio Grande itself. And so I didn't really get into talking about all that because the acequias are part of our community too. They're just, and that link that I put up here that about the law that helped to integrate the acequia system into Colorado water laws is out there too. But just, it's not the whole valley operating under acequias, so there were some, I think maybe some in Canales County. Is that right, Rhonda?
I think there's only one acequia in Conejos County, and I believe there's one acequia in Las Animas County. But all the rest are here in the southern half of Costilla County. And I believe there's like 47 that are registered. There's way more than that.
Great questions. Again, I expect that from you, and you guys never disappoint. Are there any other questions for this evening? Camille.
Hi. Good afternoon. Good evening, everybody. I don't have a question, but I just first want to comment, like, it's always nice coming from, like, as an Indigenous student, it's always nice to hear about cultural traditions like the acequias. And I did recall learning about this in one of my classes I had like a year ago. And it was really interesting. I always wondered, I was very like curious about how this all came about. And I just want to thank Rhonda for sharing the cultural tradition of information of acequias, because I don't know if the Navajo Nation specifically, if they ever had like a water system the way you guys do. And I'm like really fond of it. And I think this seminar has really like opened my eyes more, just to see the idea of community and sharing concept being really utilized in feeding the community and the cultural continuance you guys have. Yeah, that's all I wanted to point out.
I think, Camille, I think it'd be so interesting if, as you know, back that slide I had about the tribes trying to secure their water rights, if as they do get that water and access to it, I mean, I know the Navajo Nation has some big agricultural, sprinkler irrigations I've seen south of Farmington and everything, but, you know, as those water rights get more secured and access to them, it'd be really interesting to see how you could bring in some inspiration from the acequia system to actually take care of communities and not just commercial agriculture. That would be a great question, a pursuit to consider as things move in the future.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And if any of you have any further questions, I'm on Facebook or Instagram. You guys could.
Or you can email me and I'll give you their email addresses.
Sure.
I'm happy to do that. And I want to thank everybody for their attention. Again, Rio, Rhonda, good job. It's just, that was so interesting. And, you know, when I threw that topic out to you, Rio, I just wasn't sure what you were going to do with it.
I wasn't
it's
either.
Fine. And then Rhonda, when you agreed to talk, I knew that we had an earlier question about acequias. And so I'm so pleased to have had you talk about that. So with that, that's the end of the class. Everyone have a wonderful evening and we will see you next week.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.